Welcome. Really excited to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we just started this interview series a few weeks ago, and it's been really exciting to meet a lot of really interesting. So thank you for joining. Your time. So we're going to start just by asking you just to talk a little bit about yourself, your background.
All of a sudden, it's hard to hear you.
Oh, sorry. Do you hear me now?
Yes, I do.
Awesome. So I know amongst many of your other accomplishments, I'm sure everyone who's watching here has heard of you before, either heard one of your lectures or something like that. But right now, I know you're in Binghamton University, Shluchat Binghamton. So maybe just tell us a little bit about how you got there, how you grew up, and sort of just the beginning of your life story.
I'm a second generation Brooklynite on my mother's side. I was born in Crown Heights, actually, in the Lefferts General Hospital, which no longer exists. For those of you who know where Beis Rivka is on Lefferts Avenue, that very site that the school sits on was a hospital where I was born. And I grew up on Lefferts Avenue, which at the time was the West Bank of Crown Heights. It was literally the last block where there were any Jews living. Now it's kind of like center of Crown Heights. I went to Beis Rivka. I had an idyllic childhood. I loved the school. I loved my teachers, my friends, my principals. I guess, you know, the word privileged is in the news a lot. I guess you could say I had a very privileged childhood. I was surrounded by very strong role models. The way things turned out, when my mother and father got married, my maternal grandparents gave them a house to live in, which was upstairs of where my grandparents lived. So I really grew up in the same house with my grandparents. And I would say that all had a very, very profound influence on me in many, many ways. Maybe I could speak to that later. I went through Beis Rivka Elementary School, high school, and seminary. Very few people left New York to go to seminary in those days. And I was no exception. I stayed in New York. Got married. My husband learned in Kailo for 1 year. I taught in Beis Rivka. I taught the eighth grade Lumudei Kodesh, and in the afternoon I taught in the Wiener High School for Girls in Williamsburg. I taught them English and social studies, I believe. The next year I actually was fortunate enough to teach the very first cohort of what would become Machon Chana, their day yeshiva. Up until that time, they had evening classes. But that year, they opened up a full-fledged yeshiva, and I taught Likutei Sichas to the girls. And I think that's when I knew that teaching adults was just my first love.
Oh, wow.
It was a very, very special experience because the year before I taught eighth grade and I literally felt like I was walking into a war zone every single day. I meet the girls I taught those days and they wax nostalgic about those days, but I could tell you what it felt like to be on the other side of the desk.
That's been my experience in middle school also. So
it was difficult. So teaching adults that did not require any discipline and just were there to learn was just such a privilege, such a joy. It was a real gift.
Wow. Cool. So, yeah, I know that you're like a big advocate for, you know, advancing women's Torah learning and you know, promoting serious Torah learning for women. Anyone who I've spoken to about what I do is like, oh, you need to speak to Rivka Slonim, you know? So, yeah, I'd love to hear more about like where your passion for that first started and how you, I guess, got into more serious Torah learning.
It's really hard for me to trace the trajectory, you know, in any, with real precision. But if I have to think about it more critically, I think in part it has to be genetic because all of my siblings are love to learn and love to teach. My father was a teacher for most of his life. My mother was a teacher for most of her life. So you could say that, you know, it's just kind of in our DNA. Also, you know, nature and nurture. the nurture part, I don't remember ever seeing my father without a safer, unless he was bathing us. Or, I mean, like, literally, he was always learning. I can't remember waking up on Shabbos morning and there wasn't a liquidator on the table. I just can't remember that. And like I told you, I grew up in the same home as my grandparents. My grandfather taught for decades until his last days in this world. He taught two classes every single day. One was at 6 a.m. sharp and one was at 8 p.m. sharp. He never, ever veered from that schedule. The only exception was for the weddings of his children and his grandchildren. Other than that, everything revolved around those classes. So that was very much part of my childhood. Also, my grandfather could not stand the sight of us doing anything domestic. It literally made him nauseous. We laughed because when he went to shul or he went to work, whatever, he left the house, then we had to like kind of surreptitiously cook something or tidy something up. We always laughed because we didn't know who he expected would do this. He somehow figured it would just find its way to the table miraculously and maybe drop from the drop ceiling. But like, he couldn't stand seeing us do this. He would say, go do something, go learn, go read something, go get out of the kitchen. So I have to say that we laugh, my sisters and I, because we do a lot of cooking as women who run Chabad centers, but we are very, very true to our roots and we all hate doing it. Some of us less and some of us more, but we do what we have to do. I'll also say that a very fond memory I have and a very formative memory was that every night, for a number of years, when my grandfather came home, he used to work in Manhattan. And when he came home for dinner, I had to tell him a story. I had to tell him a story I read that day. Mm-hmm. And now when I look back as an adult, like, he came back after a long day. Like I said, he would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and he had also a lot of inyane klal that he took care of. And he went to the office and he came back. And instead of just being able to relax, he wanted me to tell him a story. And there was one occasion where I didn't read a story that day and I thought I would just repeat a story I had told him a few years ago. And he caught me right as I started telling me that this was not a new story and he was very disappointed. So I think he really had a very large part in nourishing and nurturing my love of reading and learning. He would test us all. I also was very fortunate in having another role model who I don't know that she ever said anything to me about this, but she was a role model. And that was my grandfather's sister. Her full name was Leah Gerari Karasik. So she's the mother of, let's say, Rivka Chitrik and Tema Gerari, Admeyev Esrim, and a few other children. So she was my grandfather's sister, and she would come to visit my grandfather. She lived in Israel, but when she came to visit, you could tell that she was a very erudite woman. And only when I was older did I learn that she and her first cousin, the Hashag sister, her name was Sonia Gerari Rosenblum. So she and Leika, Tanta Leika, Leah Gerari Karasik, both Rebbetzin, both of them, Aleha Mashalom, they learned with Rebbe Yisrael Noyach Belenitsky. He was called Rebbe Yisrael Noyach HaGadol. And the Rebbe Hashab told Rebbe Yisrael Noyach which Maimurim to teach these young women. Mm-hmm. And my father did not grow up in a Lubavitcher home, but when he came to Lubavitch, Reb Shlomo Chaim Kesselman became his mentor, his mashpia, his teacher. And my father told me that Reb Shlomo Chaim once recalled to him the scene in Kremenchuk. It seems that at a certain point, the Lubavitch Yeshiva, the Tamech Tamimim, had to run away from where they were located. And they ended up in Kremenchuk, I believe, perhaps, on the Gerari estate in Kremenchuk. And Reb Shlomo Chaim told my father that he remembers a Shabbos when these two young women, Leika and Sonia, they davened Bavoida, and after they finished davening Bavoida, they made Kiddush, and after they made Kiddush and they had a small bite to eat, then they went into the Rebbe Hashab to ask questions that they had in Chassidus. Mm-hmm. And this was anomalous because the Rebbe Hashab did not give Yechidus to any women ever, except for these two young women who went in to ask questions of him. But this was a story that I grew up with. The Rebbe Rashab was involved with the Maimarim that these girls should be taught by Rabbi Yisrael Nayach. Also, I grew up hearing that when my mother went to Israel to study there, she went to Beis Yaakov Seminary, and I think she went, to Beis Yaakov of Yerushalayim for seminary. The Rebbe told Reb Zelig Slonim, who would later become my great uncle, no, Reb Zelig Slonim, my uncle, my husband's uncle, Reb Zelig Slonim, the Rebbe told Reb Zelig Slonim to teach my mother Hasidus every Shabbos. So Reb Zelig Slonim gave her classes in Hasidus. So it's probably, genetic, and as well, just the whole, what we call in Yiddish, the arum, the environment, and the role model, and just the idea that it was never a question that this is what we should do. It really wasn't an issue. It wasn't.
Wow.
It also didn't hurt that my parents had four children first, four girls, I should say, before they had any boy.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I really feel like the expectations that parents or teachers or the community has of women makes a big difference to how we see ourselves.
Absolutely.
That's really powerful. Wow. And were there any other like role models or mentors I'm thinking of like women in your life that you can like point to that like.
Well, I mean, when I think back to my years in Beis Rivka, I have so many fond memories of great teachers. Mora Sarah Lieberman, who's still teaching, was my teacher. Rebbe Tzipora Heller was just an amazing, amazing teacher. Aleh HaShalom. I think she's your relative. Mora Nemes was a very imposing figure, to be sure, very strong, a force to be reckoned with. Mora Altshuler was one of my teachers. Mora Naiman taught me Yeshayahu. To this day, I can still recite, a decent amount of psukim by heart because of her tutelage. I could also hear her voice saying, "Banot otiyot machkimot." She always wanted us to look into the Navi. She said that the letters themselves would make us smarter. I was very blessed. I mean, I think we had some really wonderful teachers. Mark Garwitz was somebody I continued to look up to and was always enamored of. And I first met her as a teacher in 10th grade, where she used to come in and teach us Perish HaTfilah with no notes at all, with not nary a paper, nothing to reference. She would come in and it would just gush forward like a Mayan HaMezgaber, or her teachings on Tefillah. I'm sure there are more. I don't mean to leave anybody out, but those were all. I very much, I remember, looked up to Mora Lieberman. She was so erudite. She could speak to everything. Mora Heller. So many wonderful teachers I had. I had Mora Vichnin, who would travel all the way from Muncie to Beis Rivka once a week, and she taught us Kohelet. And we had Mora Chaya Cohen, who taught us Mishle. We had quite a roster of very, very wonderful teachers.
Wow, that's amazing. So moving more onto like what you've done kind of after your childhood. Maybe let's talk about I know you've written two like really well-known books, or put together two really well-known books, the Mikvah Anthology and the, what's the actual name of it?
Total Immersion.
Total Immersion, yes. Thank you. Total Immersion and Bread and Fire, which are both really, I'm sure everyone has heard of them or read them. I'd love to hear more about sort of what inspired you to collect those or put those together.
That really came out of meeting women wherever I went. At a certain point, that also grew organically. I never really decided this was going to happen, but I started speaking publicly, and wherever I spoke, I felt like there was a real hunger and a real thirst for just honest voices on the subject of mikvah, because until that time, they were really just books of halacha, books of instruction, but there were no writings that really discussed how women felt doing this mitzvah, what was difficult, what was easy, and so on and so forth. So that's how I came to do that. And the same thing happened with Bread and Fire. And by the way, that title, Bread and Fire, belongs to your brilliant mother. So she never was my teacher because we're too close in age, but she definitely was someone I always looked up to. Brilliant, brilliant woman and very, very learned. And I always knew that. And I remember, I think, shortly after we were married, I once went to the Levi Yitzchak Library for something and I saw her just sitting there with a pile of books. And I was like, wow. Yeah, but she's the one that gave me the idea for that name, Bread and Fire. And that too came about because I felt like women needed to hear from other women who were leading fulfilled, meaningful, rich, satisfying Jewish lives as women, and it wasn't necessarily happening in a synagogue. And so they say anthologies are a labor of love. It's painstaking and difficult, but they're both subjects I'm very passionate about, and if they make a difference in people's lives, that makes me very happy.
And what kind of responses have you gotten from those books?
It's been gratifying. I think people found it important, and they felt like there were voices that they could listen to, and they felt like their feelings were validated, or something was said in a particular essay that found particularly deep resonance with them. So Baruch Hashem, it's been nice.
It's incredible. So I know that you are unique in terms of, as a Chabad Shluch on campus, like really being very heavily involved in the teaching and like the actual educational side of your shluchas. And yeah, I'm curious to hear more about what you, do you feel like that's an important thing for, women who are in that role to be doing, and why, if you do feel like that's important for everyone to be involved in, why?
I very, very much hope that I am not unique. that would be very sad. I hope that at this point we have a lot of shluchas, and I know that we do have a lot of shluchas teaching heavily. I am a little bit of a dinosaur in terms of a campus shlucha, along with your mother and just a few others in our cohort. There are not many who are also bubbies already, Baruch Hashem. So that gives us more time, and it gives us more latitude, and it gives us a whole different type of flexibility and ability. But nevertheless, I think there are a lot of girls of all ages who are campus shluchas who are teaching now, and that's as it should be for a million and one reasons. I've often said that not everybody will come daven with us, but everybody can come learn with us. And it's only when people learn with us that they can really gain entree into the richness of Yiddishkeit. They have to learn with us. They have to listen to our voices. They have to listen to our minds and our hearts, and learning is the kesher shel kayama. So if somebody needs to hire a babysitter to prepare and hire a babysitter to learn, that to me is the best possible usage of your time. It pains me. It drives me absolutely bananas when I see the hours and hours that goes into menu and discussion of desserts and centerpieces, and it's all really, really important, don't get me wrong, but it's nothing compared to learning. And I firmly believe that every single one of us has so much to give, much more than we realize, and everybody can teach. Maybe not everybody can teach in front of 1,000 people or a few hundred people, but everybody can teach. And maybe not everybody could teach everything, but everybody can teach something, and I believe they can teach many, many things. It's important for our students, both male and female, to see us as learned, as authoritative, as engaged on the cerebral level, and not just the caterers, the Rebbe's caterers, as it were. There's just a million reasons. And I also believe that it's one of the most powerful ways that a woman can be nourished and nurtured for herself. You know, when people talk about self-care, I mean, I suppose that it can feel really good to have your nails and your toenails done, but I think that there's nothing as nourishing as learning something. And that allows you to kind of, in a very real way, this is not pie in the sky. I'm not trying to be poetic here. It allows you to elevate yourself above the piles of laundry and the dishes and all the mechanics of life, and to enter a different space for as long as that could be. If it's a half hour, if it's 40 minutes, everybody deserves that. You know, everybody deserves that. And I think that it's hard to describe until you yourself become enthralled with text, until you become enthralled with learning, you know, and then you can see just what a treasure and what a gift that is in life.
Mm-hmm. And because I get this from a lot of people where, you know, I think some people naturally are drawn to this type, you know,
right,
intensive learning or text-based learning. And some people aren't, or some people kind of are really busy and have a lot of, you know, especially mothers who have kids, and it's kind of hard to find time for that and to kind of see, to prioritize that in their lives. What resources women could use to sort of make that part of their lives. And I guess, to what extent is that important to be a priority when women are at stages of life when that might be more difficult?
Look, I want to use this opportunity to relate a story. My aunt, Khani Gurari, my mother's brother's wife, shouldn't be so difficult, once went into Yechidus with the Rebbe. At that point, she was having one child after another. She was extremely, extremely overwhelmed. And she cried to the Rebbe. She said she can't manage. And the Rebbe asked her how much help she had every single day in the house. And she reported whatever it was. I don't know that detail. And the Rebbe told her that whatever it was, if it was twice a week, she should double the amount of times that she was getting help in the house. Then the Rebbe told her that when the help leaves, not to look in the corners, meaning, you know, not to obsess about what they did correctly or not correctly. But here's the part I really want to share. Then he told her to go teach in the high school. So here's a woman who was coming, and she was completely overwhelmed by what was going on in her personal life. And the Rebbe gave her pragmatic instruction for what to do, which is kind of incredible in and of itself. Oh, I'm sorry. The Rebbe told her that only she can be the conduit to bring down into this world the neshamas that she is meant to bring into this world. Only she can do that. Then the Rebbe told her she should get double the amount of help that she had. Then the Rebbe told her not to look at the corners. And then the Rebbe told her to go teach in a high school, which she did for decades. And so if you're asking me if you should prioritize this, for me, I mean, it's not a question. I believe, yes, this has to be prioritized. There's no question about it. And I believe that the Rebbe was telling her this, push it for her own sanity, you know, for her own personhood. She was bogged down. The Rebbe was telling her, I know this sounds like I'm giving you another job, but actually through this, you are going to find yourself, and you're going to find sipuk nefesh. You're going to find a satisfaction that you can't find in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true for a lot of mothers with young children. So I think it might be especially important.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I wonder if maybe you could talk about more. I don't know. It sounds like you had a really ideal childhood in terms of like having people in your life who really promoted your learning and really like pushed you forward. I'm wondering if there were any challenges that you felt you faced in terms of like progressing in your own learning. And also what challenges do you think women in general face and how we can sort of overcome those challenges?
Maybe the single most formidable obstacle is still our own self-control. How do we view ourselves? Are we supposed to be learning? Are we supposed to be purveyors of knowledge? Is this something that's expected of us? And I think that there's still not this all-pervasive sense that this is mamish, our shlichus, that this is where we should kachzich. And that might be, I think, at this point in time, the most formidable obstacle. because there are so many resources, there are so many tools, there's really so much support if a woman wants to learn. All around us, women are learning. You know, the Rebbe told us, the Rebbe said publicly that he wanted women to learn every aspect of the Torah, anything that would nourish her Yiras Hashemayim and her Abbas Hashem and her Yiras Hashem, and that it should be any part of the Torah. I don't understand why we don't have Mishnayos and Gemara as a serious part of the curriculum in our girls' school. One of my daughters went to your mother's school in Ithaca, where Mishnayos was taught to both the girls and the boys. And I remember as a young mother of my daughter, I was taken aback. I was like, wow, like this was something I had never encountered. And your mother very matter-of-factly said, I don't see why the girls shouldn't be learning Mishnayos. So, but that's still not as rampant as it should be. I don't know that you can call it rampant at all. And that kind of, that saddens me and disappoints me. So I think that because of this, most women are still coming to this on their own. This becomes their passion. It's more self-propelled than what the expectation is sociologically.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think we shift that? Like, how do we shift that, I guess, that culture, you could say?
Facts on the ground. I mean, you know, if you were to teach girls Mishnayos in fourth grade and fifth grade and sixth grade and seventh grade and introduce Gemara at seventh, eighth grade level, it wouldn't be this scary terrain. It wouldn't be like you have to get a new passport to enter this country. And it is a new language. And that could be very, very daunting and still is. I mean, for myself, I was pushed into learning Mishnayos just a few years ago by an alum who at an event that we had a Friday night dinner in Manhattan, when it came over to me and she said, would you learn with me Mishnayos for a dear friend who passed on? And I was just about to say, no, I really don't feel like I could teach Mishnayos. I've never learned it myself. And then all of a sudden somebody clicked in my head and I was like, so I said, Stephanie, and she's my dear Chavrusa. We've been learning for a few years, nonstop, not every day, but I'm saying we've been learning consistently. And I looked at Stephanie and I said, I'll be very honest with you. I never learned Mishnayos before, but if you're willing to take me as Chavrusa, we'll start learning together. And we did. And Baruch Hashem, there are so many resources today. And that made it possible for me to take baby steps in the direction of learning Gemara. But if this was really integrated into the curriculum of our elementary schools and our high schools, it would look completely different. And then once you learn the terms and once you get your footing, that allows you to progress and that allows you to understand footnotes in the Chabad Sicha very differently and to understand references all over, whether you're learning Shulchan Aruch, whatever you're learning Rashi. If you know, you begin everything, it's like connecting the dots. And then, you know, when you connect the dots, you could paint something nice.
So you think the main thing, let's say, that's sort of missing from the way we're educating our girls is sort of incorporating Mishnah and Gemara into the curriculum, or are there other things you would also?
I think that would be a big change.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that would really turn things. Because it's not like we don't have good teachers in our schools, and it's not like we don't have teachers who have passion.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and then just going back to what you were saying before about sort of our own self-perception about whether this is what we're supposed to be doing. And I find that's very hard to shift. And I guess a lot of people aren't really convinced that that's really true. They're like, you know, what happened to being the Ikaris HaBayis? What happened to being, you know, my main focus is my children and being a mother, right? So like, I guess-
Why are they mutually exclusive? If you look at the Sicha, right? The Rebbe says that precisely because the mother spends all those hours with the children, that's why she should learn. That's why she should be erudite. That's why she should be able to help her children learn. And the Rebbe even says that she'll help her husband learn, and not just by giving him tea and coffee when he's learning. I also want to mention a wonderful story that's included in the collection Bread and Fire And it's a story about Rabbi Zlotnik, who was a somebody who had a very strong connection with the Rebbe. He taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary for many years. They say that the Rebbe told him to stay there and to teach Mishnayos. He taught Mishnayos that that had centered on mikveh and on Taras HaMishpacha, and this was his way of really teaching many, many people about this great mitzvah. In any case, one time he went in for Yechidus, and the Rebbe asked him about his involvement, and he mentioned that he taught a class on Shabbos afternoon in Mishnayos. And he said that this is really kind of something he enjoys very much for himself. It's on a very high level. He enjoys it. And the Rebbe grew serious and asked him, what does his wife do during that time? His wife is an artist. And he said that she and the other women, they prepare the shalashuddas for the group. So the Rebbe said, she should be teaching Mishnayos as well. And she was very, very taken aback. I think her name is Alice. Wait, hold on a second. I'm going to get her name. I want to say this correctly. Just give me a second. Because their daughter wrote this story for Bread and Fire. I think it's Alice Lotnik, but I'm just going to get in the name. Her story is called Teaching Mishnah in Jerusalem, and her name is Karen Kirschenbaum. Let's see. Oh, she writes that her father told the Rebbe about a Talmud shir that he taught on Shabbos afternoon in Riverdale. Sorry about that. And when he asked what the wife does, what the wives of the shir members did during the shir, my father explained that the shir rotated every week to a different home, and the women prepared the Suda Shlishit meal for the men. The Rebbe suggested that the women should also have their own study group. And her mother started teaching a Mishnah study group for women that continued for 25 years. And she says, 19 years ago, I started a Mishnah study group that meets every Shabbat afternoon. So they've been studying Mishnah. Now she says that just recently we completed all 63 tractates of the Mishnah. We made a festive siyum. It was a great feeling of accomplishment for all the women of the shir. But I think somewhere in this essay, she talks about how she teaches all of her boys Shisha Sidri Mishnah before their bar mitzvah.
Wow.
So I reference this because, I mean, if the Rebbe wanted this from Alice, and I'm not finding her name, it's Alice or Alison Zlotnik, then why are we different? And because this was something that was in her home, so then it became something she did when she grew up. Mm-hmm. Oh, here it is. About 2 years before my son's bar mitzvah, my son and I decided to study all of Shas Mishnayot together and make a siyum in honor of his bar mitzvah. We studied approximately one chapter of Mishnah every day, approximately 45 minutes daily for 2 years, and finished studying in time for his bar mitzvah.
Mm. Wow. So just another question. So, you know, I think we like to say that Rebbe spoke about this a lot, you know, sort of promoting this idea. So why do you think that the trend hasn't changed yet? You know, why do you feel like we still have this sort of culture of not feeling like this is what?
I don't know. It's a good question. I think change happens very slowly. Mm-hmm. I think that we're light years behind what the Rebbe wanted from us in so many ways. You know, I think about things like prison reform. I think about what's going on right in America today. Mm-hmm. And I think about how the Rebbe spoke about prison reform to a group of Hasidim, most of whom might have been first generation Americans or maybe second generation Americans. And I imagine that in their heads, they were like, we don't know what he's talking about. We're going to shake and we're going to shuckle this way and that way because it's a farbringen and the Rebbe is speaking to us. But like, you know, things like moments of silence. I think we're behind in so many ways. I don't think this is the only way in which we're just straining to understand. We're just beginning to get a glimpse in what the Rebbe wanted from us on so many different fronts in so many different ways. And this is just one of them.
Yeah.
But I think people become entrenched in patterns. I think, you know, you have certain teachers teaching for many, many years. You have a certain curriculum. You know, I think change is slow. But look, when I was a student, I don't remember that we had any women teaching Tanya or teaching Maimarin, you know. Today, that has changed completely.
Yeah, it's definitely shifted drastically. I mean,
so I don't see why this can't happen as well. I think, you know, but it takes time.
Yeah, definitely. Is there anything particular that you really enjoy learning that you could share with us? Maybe something unique that people might not know about, or just something that you're really passionate about?
No, I'm an equal opportunity. I really enjoy learning lots of things, Baruch Hashem. I think that teaching is a very, very unique way of learning. It forces you to really learn things, you hope, to the best of your ability, but it's only when you articulate it and you teach it that you really, really understand it. And maybe when you learn it or teach it 30 times, you begin to really, really, really understand it. But I love teaching sichas. I love teaching parsha. I love teaching JLI classes of all kinds. I don't know. I just, you know, I really, really enjoy it. I would never say that I would only do, like, I would study Mishnah with somebody in Chavrusa because I'm just really, really a novice. You know, but generally speaking, I just enjoy sharing ideas. So anything I'm excited about, I like to share.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I have a love for Rashi Sichas. I've been teaching Rashi Sichas for a long time. Mm-hmm. Something different. I've been teaching Hilchot Nida to girls for about 32 years now. So every single semester, I've been teaching a cohort of girls Hilchot Nida, and I just feel that's a really, really important thing for young women to learn. Quite apart from if they're engaged or not, which they're not, most of my students here at Binghamton. I think it's really important for them to learn those halachas and to begin to understand that mitzvah and the whole idea of marriage and relationships and the relationship with Hashem really deeply.
And when you teach halachas, Nida, do you go through sort of like the background in the Mishnah Gemara?
I do not. Because as it is, it's like an 8-week course. Uh-huh. And quite a commitment, and that would be pushing it. So I don't. Mm-hmm. That could be a lot of fun.
I'm curious because, you know, we recently did a course like that where we did, it was actually sort of a mix of halacha and chassidus, and we sort of tried to give people some of the background of like the halachic principles behind halachas nida and also some of the chassidic concepts. Mm-hmm. And one question we got a lot was you know, people feel like with halachas nida especially, but I guess really any area of halacha, there's already so much complexity and there's already so much room for error. And, you know, isn't it, you know, giving women so much background into like the original sources and the original Gemaras and even realizing that a lot of what we do is only, you know, a Durabanan or a Minhag, right? So like, isn't that going to sort of detract from their seriousness or how seriously they take their observance? So I'm wondering if you could respond to that, what your thoughts are.
I hear that concern. Part of that concern, I think, has to do with perhaps the feminine modality being more aligned with practicality. And so I'm going to take what I learn and bring it into my kitchen, my bedroom, my dining room, very practically. And while we enjoy learning deeply, perhaps what we learn is not as abstruse and not as abstract and not as at a remove. And so perhaps there is a fear that, you know, looking at the sources and seeing that perhaps there might be latitude, even though we do it a certain way, but there might be latitude to do a different way, might open up a possibility for someone perhaps taking a more lax attitude. I personally believe that the kind of woman who's going to sit in this kind of class is probably doing so because of her love of learning, and she's not looking for a way out halachically. I think we have to trust people. I think we have to, we're all the cheskas kashrus and more, and we have to trust. Now, it may not be the appropriate thing to put in the public domain, as it were, but if there's a self-selected group of people who are coming to learn this, I personally don't share that concern, especially if you're learning Nigla and Chassidus together. You know, the Rebbe always used to stress that the most important thing in learning Torah is to say the bracha before Nisein HaTorah, to remember whose Torah you're learning, to remember what the purpose of learning Torah is. And if you're doing it from that point of departure and that point of return, then I think that you mitigate the danger that the knowledge will be used in any way other than to further propel Torah mitzvahs. You know, will be used in any way that could be contrary to the kavana.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know we're moving away from like our original script, but as I'm talking to you, like more questions are coming up. So I'm wondering, just going back to what you were saying before about how, you know, some people might see how, you know, a woman might tend to learn things in a more and see it more in its practical application. So I'm curious if you feel, you know, you mentioned before that you feel like girls should be introduced to Mishnah and Gemara at a younger age. Do you feel like there are differences in terms of what we should be, what our curriculum for girls should be, based on, I guess, what girls' approach to learning is or should be?
Perhaps. I mean, I would have to give this a lot more thought, and I'm hardly in a position to speak because I've just learned just a few Masechtas Mishnayos. This coronavirus has been very wonderful in that it has forced us all into a Myra. This was the very first time that I learned the whole Saita together with my husband and my sons. It was a very, very special experience. So I have nothing in this area that I can't speak to what the curriculum would look like, but perhaps it would be different than what the curriculum looks like for boys, but that's hardly really to me, the area of focus. What would be more important is to provide those tools and entree into this whole sea, this whole yam of Torah that is inaccessible because you weren't introduced to the vocabulary, the system, mm-hmm. context.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. I can't think what else I could ask here. So if like it's a woman are sort of, you know, either just starting to restart their learning or just starting to make time, like what do you feel like is most important for a woman to sort of make time to learn, if you could?
I would say Chassidus. I would say the Rebbe's Sichus. I would say that would be paramount. But maybe another way to approach this question is, what speaks to the woman? What will make her heart soar? What will make, you know, what will light up her brain? What will inflame her passion? Mm-hmm. Maybe that's another way of, because the Rebbe says that it should be, a woman should learn any aspects of Torah that strengthen her Avas Hashem and her Yiras Hashem. So for different women, it might look differently. As a Lubavitcher Chassidista, I think that the Sichas are just such a treasure trove, and they speak to you on so many different levels.
Mm. So I see somebody on our Facebook live commented, curious if Mrs. Lenham has any current writing projects in the works, or favorite authors, or book recommendations for the aspiring learner.
book recommendations. Some of these are very, very classic, but I will still throw it out there. I think anything by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan is 24 karat gold. It's really wonderful. Adin Steinsaltz, Jonathan Sachs, you know, these are classic authors. There's just so much to learn. I love Yankee Tauber's writings. I think he's absolutely brilliant. So anything he's written, again, 24 karat gold. I don't know. I didn't come prepared to this. If you want to learn Hasidus, you have to learn Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Shachet Alba Shalom's practical concepts, mystical concepts in Hasidism. That's a classic. And that's not something that's an easy read. At least for me, it wasn't. I've read it many, many, many times, and I'm sure that I still don't understand, you know, a tiny percentage of what he's trying to say. There's a trilogy that he wrote, Rabbi Shachet also wrote for Kahas on prayer. Can't remember right now what they're called. There's a wonderful book by Kahas, To Touch the Divine, fantastic essays in that collection. I love that. I love the things that Dr. Brower has written. He hasn't written enough. I hope he'll write a lot more. I don't know. I have to think this through.
Okay. I wasn't
prepared for that.
Any current writing projects that you have? She also asked.
I'm working on something, but I'm not prepared to talk about it yet. But
sounds mysterious. Okay. What other questions here? Can you ask how she sees the change happening in baby steps? I'm assuming this is going back to what you were saying before. How do you see the change happening in baby steps, and what do you feel should come first?
Well, I think changing the curriculum in our elementary school and then in our high school would be a baby step. I think that would create a sea change, and I think that should happen immediately. We're just about, you know, a few decades late here. And in terms of how is this going to happen, every woman in her own home, in her own mind, in her own life. You know, that's how it happens. Facts on the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just going back to the way we started, I feel like the way the expectations we raise our children with is like, that has the biggest impact of all. So
Yeah.
People don't think so.
It's so terrible that children should get up in the morning and they on Shabbos morning and they should see that their parents are learning the Kutei Torah together. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's not possible when you have tiny kids. but you know, a little bit later, like, Marash.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Any other questions here? Oh, does she feel that Chassidus would be able to be shared to women that are not Chabad?
Absolutely. the whole world is panting at our door. There's never been a time where people are so open and so appreciative.
Okay. If anybody else wants to post a question, feel free to do so. That's all we have so far. Okay. Or if anyone who's on the Zoom wants to unmute themselves, you can also feel free to ask. okay. Well, I guess we'll close up here. Is there any closing thoughts or just messages you'd want to share with women around the world who are listening about, I guess, Torah learning or anything else? Or Judaism?
Yes, I want to say to you that you're absolutely awe-inspiring. that what you're doing is so important, and it's so amazing that you found this calling and this passion, and that you're creating such a change and making so many waves, Baruch Hashem, of the best kind, of the most wonderful kind. And I wish you Hatzlacha Rabba Muflaga, and Hatzlacha should just completely, completely defy all of your expectations, and you should have a lot of Chassidus Shenachas from everybody that comes through the Bat Sheva Learning Center, and all the ripple effects that come from that.
Thank you so much. Thank you
for the opportunity.
Okay. All right. Let me just check in one more time. I agree. Okay. That's what we're getting. All right. Thank you so much for everyone who's watching, and thank you for making time to join us. That was really
good night.
The insightful. You too. Have a good night.